You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you very, very much, Jan.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see you all. Let me start by sharing with you two remarks which I made on Saturday, 3 days ago, the day on which Egyptians went to the polls to vote in the referendum on the constitutional amendments. And the first remark is the turnout. For the first time in modern Egyptian history, we had over 40% of eligible Egyptian voters participating in an election. The last referendum, which took place in 2007, was in relation to constitutional amendments as well. Participation was less than 5%. In fact, according to non-governmental sources, it was 2%. The last elections, parliamentary elections, which we had was in 2010, and participation by Egyptian voters in the elections, the turnout was less than 20%. Once again, according to non-governmental organizations, between 10 and 15%. So what we saw on Saturday was, for the first time in modern Egyptian history, and here my frame of reference or the time frame of reference is since 1952, since the Republic was created. For the first time, we saw 40% of the Egyptian voters going to the polls and participating in a democratic test. In fact, it was the first democratic test in Egypt since 1952, where citizens really had a choice between a yes to the suggested amendments and the procedures and timeline related to them, and a no to the amendments, which implied a desire to change the constitution and not to amend the old constitution. So it's quite interesting to take that voter turnout into consideration and really see what it tells us, because it tells us, to my mind, that Egyptians are committed to build their country in a democratic manner, are committed to shoulder their responsibilities as citizens, participating in democratic tests in times of choice. And it tells us that whatever was said prior to January 25, and it was not only a political or intellectual talk, it was academic literature as well, whatever was said about the inability or incompatibility of specific elements of Egyptian political culture, or the lack of readiness among Egyptians to push for democracy, to transition their country to democracy, so that whatever we spend time dealing with, trying to understand, trying to analyze, is definitely less relevant as we did consider before January 25. I mean, I myself and different scholars, be it from Egypt or from outside, we're really struggling to understand why is it that we are not transitioning to democracy. And many of us offered, as an analytical background, culturalist approach, highlighting the lack of readiness among Egyptians for democratic governance, to demand democracy. And I guess this component which shaped our perception, not only of Egypt but of many Arab countries, is changing drastically as of now, seeing and witnessing what happened in Tunisia, seeing and witnessing what is happening in Libya, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Egypt, and elsewhere. The second remark is more related to the details of the polling process on Saturday. Because what we used to have in Egypt before last Saturday was basically in elections, in referenda, was a polling process which was not complete, which was never complete. Sometimes we had no voters. As I said, the voter turnout was extremely low. Sometimes we had voters, but we did not have contested seats, municipal elections, for example, where seats were to 95-96% in the last two rounds of the municipal elections. Thank you very much. In the last two rounds of the municipal elections, in a pre-election mode assigned to the former ruling party of the National Democratic Party. Sometimes we had voters and contested seats, and we did not have election monitors. We did not have an oversight body to monitor the election process. This time, we really had the three elements coming together to create, for the first time since 1952, a serious electoral process. We had voters, we had a choice between yes and no, which was treated in a detailed manner in the Egyptian public opinion. Citizens were well informed about what they were going to choose, not all of them, but many of them. And we had judges in every polling center overseeing the process, and we had, for the first time, civil society monitors who participated in the process and were not hindered to do their job. And once again, related to these elements, the one element which used to be dominant, which was dominant in previous Egyptian elections, which was the interference of the security apparatus, did not exist. For the first time, we saw security forces standing outside the polling centers, not inside the polling centers. We did not have the bloodshed which characterized most Egyptian elections in the last years. We did not have reports of wounded, killed Egyptians after the referendum day. So it's to my mind, these two remarks which I'm trying to start my presentation with are a clear or attest to the fact that Egypt is transitioning in an interesting, in a dynamic, and of course in a very tough manner, away from Mubarak's autocracy, from the autocracy which was in fact created by the 1952 Free Officers Movement, and to democratic governance, which is being contested and is going to be contested by different forces in the country. Second point which I would like to make is really to reflect a bit on what has been happening in Egypt since January 25 and up until today. Now, knowing the outcome of the referendum was 77.8% or 0.6% of citizens who participated in the referendum saying yes to the amendments, and a bit more than 22 saying no. And knowing that since the amendments were accepted by the majority of Egyptian citizens, that we are going to see the timeline and the procedures related to the amendments unfold in the next few months, and I'm going to address them in my third point. But now, secondly, the second point which I would like to make is to reflect a bit briefly on what has been changing in Egypt, in Egyptian politics, since January 25. And to my mind, there are four major issues which have changed. The first issue is the role of Egyptian citizens in Egyptian politics. Because what we have been having since 1952 was a political formula which was based on pushing out citizens from politics, pushing them away from politics, using whatever instruments were out there for autocratic governments to use, repressive security institutions, a repressive security arm, an informal security network which should be in fact described as an informal terrorizing network, using legal restrictions, political restrictions on political forces, political parties, social movements, civil society. So the formula with which Egypt was ruled since 1952 was to a great extent based on pushing citizens out of politics. And what has been changing since January 25 is that citizens are back. and are playing politics and are, in fact, struggling in too many different ways to stay in the political game. Citizens, millions, I mean, the first estimate of the number of Egyptians who took out to the streets between January 25 and February 11 is anywhere between 12 and 14 million, which is an unprecedented number of people to take out to the streets in Egypt since 1919. For the first time, we had that many Egyptians taking out to the streets for one cause, which was to remove Mubarak and to change the system. And those citizens who protested between January 25 and February 11 are struggling as of now to stay in the political game in different ways. And the fact that they went to the polls on Saturday and participated, over 40%, as I said, turnout is an attest that they are going to stay in. They are trying to create political parties, civil society initiatives. I mean, if you are in Egypt, you hear not only on a daily basis, but every hour about a new initiative which is being put forward and launched. So there is a clear dynamism. The populace is dynamic, is interested, is participating in debates in different manners. And they are back, citizens are back to Egyptian politics in the most direct manner. They did not wait for political parties or opposition movements to take up their cause. They did it themselves, which was the beauty of what happened in January 25, and which was one of the reasons why I kept saying, whenever I had time to talk to the media between January 25 and February 11, so it's not about leadership. People kept asking, and where is the leadership of the protest movement? I said, it's not a movement. These are basically demands which are being put forward and shared by a huge number of Egyptians. And they did not need leadership until February 11, because their demands were articulated very well and were very clear. And because leadership would have been probably more of a limiting, would have had a limiting impact on the dynamic protest movement, on the revolution, the dynamic protest movement turning into a revolution in the 3 weeks between January 25 and February 11. So citizens are back in the most direct manner, using the street, regaining control over the street as a political arena, which once again did not exist in Egypt since 1952. Regaining the street, regaining the public space as a political arena, as an arena to struggle politically, is going to be a defining feature of Egyptian politics in the next years. This is not going to wither away anytime soon, and this is not going to be related only to big events. We had some citizens protesting once on Sunday and Monday once the results of the referendum were announced, but this is going to be a defining feature of Egyptian politics, and it's going to be dominant in a dominant component in Egyptian politics, especially as long as political parties and civil society organizations, the intermediary groups in between, which are supposed to represent citizens and their interests, as long as they stay weak, and they are going to stay weak, structurally weak for some time. The second big change which happened in Egypt and it continues to unfold as we talk is the fact that the state which we, and the state and its institutions which we, and it's less a change and maybe more of a discovery for Egyptian citizens as well as for analysts following Egypt from afar. The state, the Egyptian state, which we for a very long time used to see as a strong and viable state, as a mighty state with mighty institutions, we discovered how weak that state is. And we discovered that after a few days of a dynamic protest movement turning into a revolution. In fact, after 3 days, January 25 to January 28, it was only the military establishment which was the one viable institution in Egypt to take care of policing society, of opening up a political roadmap for a solution, and of ultimately removing former President Mubarak from office and getting into the transitional period in which we are. And this is more of a very challenging discovery, because what we need right now in Egypt and what we will need, and which makes the transitional period to democracy even more complicated, is that we need to do some state building as well. It's not only about transitioning to democracy. And the state building process should not be reduced to the big question and huge challenge of the security sector and how to reform the security sector. And some initial steps were undertaken. Homeland intelligence was dismantled. There are some interesting initiatives which are being undertaken by the government, to the government's credit. But once again, it's not only about the security sector, it's about rebuilding state institutions in a democratic, transparent, and citizens-serving manner. And this is going to be one of the big priorities of Egypt in the next years as well. And to that, one of the interesting side points of the business of state building, which we have to undertake, is how to re-establish, based on democratic pillars, the interrelations between the three branches of government, between the executives, the legislature, and the judiciary. Because what we had in the last decade, and once again, this is not a creation of Mubarak, this exists since 1952, we have had a very dominant executive, which was reduced over time to the president, in the last years to the president and his family. And we had, since 1952, a weakened legislature and judiciary which lacked autonomy, which lacked independence. So how to rebuild and reshape interrelations, and based on what kind of checks and balances. And all of that leads to the big question, which is going to be contested once we start with the business of drafting the new constitution. Are we going to move in the direction of a parliamentary republic or a presidential republic, as we have been having it in an autocratic manner since 1952? All of this is going to come back and be at the forefront of the national debates once we start with the drafting of the new constitution. The third big issue, to my mind, which needs to be positively to be taken care of and to be reflected upon, is, and here I'm not. Of course, it's quite difficult for someone who has been part of what's going on not to romanticize whoever was in Egypt between January 25 and February 11 must have fallen in love with what Egyptians were able to do. And so there is a degree of romanticization, probably, in what I'm going to say. But sort of, to my mind, the third big issue which we need to take into consideration is the fact that whatever we saw in Egyptian society prior to January 25, in terms of crises and factors limiting our capability in building a modern society and modern polity. And here I'm referring to indicators of economic development, social development, high levels of literacy. Over 17 million Egyptians, over 20%, a bit more than 20%, are not educated. Over 40% Egyptians live below the poverty line. But I'm also referring to sectarian tensions and acts of sectarian violence, which have been relevant in Egypt in the last three decades. So that sad societal picture, which we have been encountering in the last years, where at least between January 25 and February 11, was pushed aside. with all its different elements and components. We did not see sectarian tensions, not only in Tahrir Square, but elsewhere in Egypt. In fact, we saw Egyptian Copts participating as at an equal level, like Egyptian Muslims. We did not see tensions across social boundaries between rich and poor. And in fact, whoever states that the Egyptian revolution was a middle-class revolution really misses the point. I mean, this was a revolution in which every single sector in society participated, and it was not a middle-class revolution, and it was not driven by the middle-class demand on democracy and human rights. People had too many different entry points to demand democracy coming from different social backgrounds. So what I'm trying to say is that for whatever reason, at a certain crucial moment in Egyptian history, that society was able to push aside its long history of sectarian tensions, its long history of social tensions across classes, and present itself in an impressive, civilized manner, in a manner which was peaceful, which was committed to the country, which did not commit a single act of violence, even as violence was being imposed on the scene by the former regime, by the former president and his aides. So here, it's of course, sectarian tensions continue to exist. In fact, they once again were getting back at us right after the removal of Mubarak. I'm not sure how many of you took note of the incidents in one village in Upper Egypt, Seoul, in which a church was burned and some tensions between Salafi groups and the Coptic population were turning violent for a few days. Tensions between social classes continue to exist, and we see sort of the long list of social and economic demands of the needy and the poor coming up and leading to daily protest activities, daily labor sit-ins, daily strikes. And so this is bound to happen and will continue to happen. But the energy and the commitment, to my mind, which enabled Egyptians to push aside their differences and unite behind the national cause is going to be a defining feature of Egyptian politics as well. I saw it on Saturday. The referendum was managed peacefully in spite of all differences, in spite of a very tough controversy before Saturday, whether the amendments was the right path to take or whether we are really undermining the revolution and its democratic demand. And I was on the second side. I was against the amendments, for saying no to the amendments. And at the end of the day, it was managed very peacefully, and the controversy was contained in an impressive democratic manner up until now. The fourth issue, what I'm saying with a third point is, yes, it's a poor country. Yes, we have different social and economic crises. We have sectarian tensions. But the energy, the positive energy, which is really unleashed by the demand on democracy, is going to be a defining feature that will enable Egyptians to move forward in spite of the big social, economic, and societal challenges in general. The fourth point in terms of big changes is the fact that Egyptians, maybe in a regional moment which is not preferable to that, but Egyptians stopped looking outside their country. Even events in Libya, apart from expressing solidarity, is not on anyone's mind. People are preoccupied with what is happening in Egypt. So it's in a way, it's a highly homegrown development which we are undergoing. It's a revolution which pushes people to look inside and stop looking outside, even when it gets close to our doors. In fact, Libya was probably apart from the solidarity component with Arabs demanding democracy elsewhere, and of course we Egyptians express that solidarity, but Libya is probably relevant or was a bit relevant until Egyptian workers, guest workers, were brought back home. But apart from that, it's a nation which is preoccupied with its own internal affairs and is not willing, as far as I can tell, to devote any attention elsewhere. A clear test was the announcement of the Supreme Council of the military forces, of the armed forces, which was addressed to Israel, but to Western powers as well, that the binding regional international treaties are not going to be touched. And this was accepted, was not contested, even by religious forces like the Muslim Brotherhood. It was not contested. And it's to my mind, it's a sign of maturity, of a political culture which is maturing while democratizing. Of course, not ignoring the Arab component, but sort of taking a completely different approach while looking at that Arab component, not the rhetorical, categorical no's, or not the rhetorical, categorical anti-Western or anti-Israeli stances which we hear elsewhere, but more of, I guess, a nation being aware of the challenges ahead and being aware of the test in which it is, and being aware of the fact that if it manages to build democracy, it's bound to be inspiring elsewhere in the region. That image of Egypt, which of the Egyptian centrality in the Arab world, which was long lost because of the stagnation under Mubarak, can be regained if we manage to build democracy. And to my mind, a very rational approach to managing yourself in times of transition in the regional environment, in the tough regional environment in which we are. Fine. So what are the challenges ahead? So now since a clear majority of Egyptians approved the amendments on Saturday, we are well into the procedures and the timeline defined and inherent to the constitutional amendments. The challenges ahead are the following. We will have parliamentary elections in a maximum of 6 months, September 2011. The first challenge looking ahead to the parliamentary elections is the question of the electoral system. Are we going to elect the new Egyptian parliament and it's going to be a two-chamber parliament? We'll still have the Shura Consultative Council, which in fact had no role whatsoever in the last years apart from approving legislation and playing a highly negative role in containing political parties and civil society organizations and in dominating the media landscape. We'll continue to have the People's Assembly as a lower chamber and the Shura Consultative Council as the upper chamber of the Egyptian parliament, at least until a new constitution is drafted and approved. So the first challenge is about the electoral system. Are we going to have conduct our elections based on the individual candidate system, which we had in the last two decades, in fact, most of the last three decades, and which produced very weak parliaments, which enabled patrimonial networks, tribal loyalties to dominate the parliamentary elections, enabled corrupt business leaders, corrupt politicians to sustain their seats in the parliament for a long time, or as we prefer, as many forces in Egypt prefer, or are we going to shift to a mixed system where we have party lists and a margin for independence for individual candidates, similar to what we have in Germany, but not as complicated as the German system is, because the German system will take ages to implement in Egypt. But sort of the idea of having a mixed system. And this is a number one challenge and a big debate which is emerging as of now in Egypt. Once we got the results of the referendum, we moved right away to raise the question of the electoral system. And what I'm going to say is not off the record. It's based on conversations which I did have with a group of Egyptian politicians, writers, intellectuals, with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. Probably we will be transitioning to a mixed system where we will have party lists and a margin for independence. But the specifics are yet to be worked out. And in fact, it's an additional sign for the commitment, as they see it, of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to really help the country to democratize. Of course, they have their mistakes. There are some issues where they push in the wrong direction, but they are, in general, committed to create strong elected institutions and pull out of their current role, which is managing as a legislative as well as an executive power Egyptian politics. The second big challenge which we have is how to give political groups, movements, especially groups and movements which did not exist before January 25 and which are trying to organize, to assemble, to attract Egyptian citizens who made the revolution to join them, be it as members or as supporters, how to give those new forces enough time to really compete in the upcoming elections. Because we have a clear duality which can be very risky in Egypt and can lead to an imbalanced parliament. And this was my main reason to say no to the amendments, because I feel that we would have needed a bit more time to get new powers to assemble and to be able to compete seriously in the upcoming parliamentary elections. We have two powers which are ready and know how to compete in Egyptian parliamentary elections and have been competing in parliamentary elections since the late 1970s. And the first power among them is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, part of the national alliance that has been pushing for democratization the last years and should not be punished for its excellent work in terms of constituency building and reaching out to the electorate, and should not be punished for that. But it's a mighty power which we'll have to reckon with. And the second force is, although I see it as sort of overly rated in Egyptian public debates, so that whatever remained from the former governing ruling party, the National Democratic Party, I mean, to my mind, they do not stand a great chance to get a strong representation in the new parliament, but they are still there. And the layer in which they primarily exist is a layer of the municipal councils. Because the parliament has been dissolved, the party headquarters is burned, party offices in different regions in Egypt are being taken away from the party. Of course, we are yet to see that legalized. Of course, we are demanding an investigation commission to look into the corruption of the NDP. In fact, to demand from the NDP to pay for the headquarters and offices which it has been occupying from a national perspective since 1978, and to pay for all the years between 1978 and 2011, which would mean a big blow to that party financial capabilities. But we are yet to see that investigation commission formed. It might happen soon, but it's yet to be the case. But NDP elements really exist at the municipal level. Municipal councils continue to exist. They are not dissolved, and they are controlled to 99.6 or 0.7% by the NDP. So we have those two forces with all due differences between the Muslim Brotherhood and the remaining elements of the NDP. And we have on the other side existing political parties, legal opposition parties, which for different reasons have been limited, hindered in terms of reaching out to voters, building constituencies, and are having a hard time trying to adapt to the changes. And we have the new forces which are trying to assemble, creating liberal and leftist political party platforms. So unless we manage to empower the second group of actors, legal parties which existed before January 25, and new parties which are trying to assemble, and as Jan mentioned, I am part of an initiative to establish a socially responsible liberal party platform, which will be announced next week. But once again, unless we have enough resources, unless we get active very soon in reaching out beyond the urban centers to be able to compete, that duality between strong, mighty Muslim Brotherhood plus NDP and weak liberal and leftist forces, be it old or new, is going to shape the new parliament. And should that happen, which I do not hope is going to be the case, but there is an element possibility, more than a possibility, that it will happen. Should that happen, that is going to be quite influential in terms of shaping Egypt's political future for two reasons. One, the parliament will represent primarily the interests and perceptions and views of the two mighty groups and discriminate against all others. Secondly, the parliament itself, based on the procedures built in the amendments that were passed on Saturday, the parliament will, the elected members of the parliament, of the two chambers, People's Assembly and the Shura Council, will elect the members of the Constitutional Assembly, which will draft a new constitution. Of course, they will elect, they are entitled to elect the members, the MPs themselves, entitled to elect the members of the Constitutional Assembly from within or from outside. So you can get members from the parliament to be in the Constitutional Assembly, as well as members from outside. But an imbalanced parliament is bound to produce an imbalanced Constitutional Assembly. And a parliament which discriminates against liberal and leftist views and sort of puts forward more of, once again without excluding them, more of religious-based political views and constitutional views, is bound to generate a constitution that will at least not meet the desires and wishes of a strong segment of the Egyptian population. In fact, there is an additional component into that duality which I described, which is the fact that most citizens who participated in the revolution were never members of political parties, never went to the elections before, and really need time to be organized in terms of their interests, their perceptions, and need new parties to reach out to them. I mean, those were representatives of the 80% Egyptian voters who never went to the elections before, since 1978. Because, as I said, the maximum turnout we had before January 25 was around 20%. So we had 80%. And right now the Egyptian votership is 47 million citizens. We had 80% of them who basically abstained from entering into politics, from participating in politics. And they need time to be organized and to reflect their interests. In fact, to create a new image for politics, because when you are on the ground and you see old party members, be it, or old Muslim Brothers members trying to play politics, you really pause for a second and ask yourself, is that the new image of politics which Egyptians made the revolution for? I mean, are those people able to personalize and embody the new spirit of a democratic governance, of a democratic Egypt? And I mean, I cannot help but to answer that question with a clear no. So we need a new image. We need new participants in Egyptian politics, and not simply whoever was there before. The third and final challenge which I'm going to outline, and once again, of course, I'm looking ahead, means in the next 6 months. I'm not looking beyond that frame of reference. The third challenge is to agree on sort of what are the red lines and what are what are not the red lines once the debate about the new constitution starts. And I'm referring to red lines which are perceived by some segments in the Egyptian population as such. Article 2 in the current Egyptian constitution, which stipulates that Sharia, principles of Sharia, Mabadi' al-Sharia, are the primary source of legislation. It's a red line for a, should not be touched for a strong segment, constituency in Egypt, and it's not a red line for other segments and constituencies. The article providing and stipulating that the Egyptian state has a religion. Islam is the religion of the state. It's once again a red line for some, not a red line for others. The article in the 1971 constitution providing for a minimum of 50% workers and peasants representation in all legislative councils. It's a red line for some and not a red line for some others. And the article, basically the structure, the very structure of the Egyptian political system as a presidential system, as opposed to forces which favor, and I am among those national figures and forces and intellectuals who favor a shift to a parliamentary democracy. So contesting those red lines is going to be very tough, but it's bound to happen. Let me close by highlighting how tough that contestation can be. Because one, in fact not one, but the major argument used by the Muslim Brotherhood and religious groups before the Saturday referendum to convince citizens to go and vote with a yes to the amendments. And in spite of the fact that Article number 2 was not part and is not part of the articles which are amended, the main argument used by the Brotherhood and other religious forces to convince citizens to go and vote with a yes was that if you voted no, Article 2 might be in danger. And this mobilized outside the urban centers citizens in such an intensive manner and led, especially in the Delta region, to end results with over 90%, 95% saying yes out of that fear that maybe Article 2 or the state religion article might be touched. Of course, it's unfortunately legitimate in politics, but it's morally, intellectually not a sound strategy because you are misleading voters. And because everyone knows that once we have and we will have a new constitution, that those issues will come up. But they were not part of what was being contested before Saturday. But it gives you a sense of how tough the contestation is going to be. Right. That's more or less where we stand. Let me stop here and take your questions.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Omar. Before I open up to the audience and I can see and hear some feet shuffling already, I would like to ask a question. I'm so tempted to ask a CNN question, which would be like, what is it like to be in a revolution like this? But I would rather ask a BBC question and connect some dots of what you said just now. You said that this was a revolution that was carried by the people and not by any kind of movement, not by any kind of institution. And then you said that the institutions that do exist turned out to be rather weak as opposed to strong like we would have expected them to be. And then you also said that 99.9% of the local councils are still in the hand of the old forces. Now, given that democracy depends on more than just elections and some kind of demand that people postulate, but on institutions, does this bode well for a post-election Egypt, the fact that the institutions are so weak and to the extent that they do exist are still in the hand of the powers that be?
Well, I mean, the local councils, the municipal councils are, I wouldn't describe them as strong institutions. I mean, they are active in terms of lobbying, mobilizing citizens for NDP figures. And maybe we have to make a step backward to make it clear that when I refer to NDP politicians or NDP figures or NDP members in the municipal councils, I'm not referring to party politicians who were politicized and indoctrinated based on that party's ideology or perception or view. No, it's a network, it's a patrimonial network. It's a network of local leaders, business figures, some local politicians coming together, and this was the only logic for them to join the NDP, who joined the NDP because it was the governing and ruling party. And they do not have a set of ideas. They have interests which they are going to protect, and those interests are primarily economic interests. How to counterbalance that is going to be very tough in the elections, because most of them are very well connected in their local settings. And once again, if we, which I do not expect, if we will conduct our elections based on the individual candidate system which we had before, those guys will have an excellent starting point to get the same results which they have been getting in the last decades. If we move to a mixed system where we have party lists, you can counterbalance legally here their significance. I am aware of some initiatives which are going on to attract some of those away from the old system and give them some guarantees, some safeguards for their interests, and push them to join new forces or existing forces which were in the opposition spectrum before. The Muslim Brotherhood is doing much of that as of now on the ground, which is once again an attest to how mighty their organizational structure is. I mean, they can reach out quickly and they can offer a secured seat in the People's Assembly, which no one else can offer. In fact, I mean, and if you take their statement seriously by the Brotherhood that they are going to contest anywhere between 35% to 40% of the seats of the People's Assembly, definitely they know that they will get more than 20%, sort of the block which they have secured already. Secondly, the bigger question is how to democratize, how to manage a transition to democracy while we have weak institutions. And while movements, political movements on the ground are still aligning, trying to create their own organizational structures and do their outreach activities, that's going to be very tough. And to an extent, one has to factor in that probably the military establishment is going to be with us for some time in a safeguarding mission as the most viable institution in the country. Not primarily similar to what has been happening in Turkey, or what unfolded in Turkey in the last years, but in a way they are going to safeguard the process for some time. Secondly, the judiciary will play a crucial role. And while we have had since, in fact, the 1950s, very weak parliaments, the judiciary, in spite of the lack of autonomy, especially under Mubarak, has managed to sustain its existence as a proper and a functioning institution. And it was the judiciary which managed, in fact, the big steps, judicial elements and structures, which managed the big steps that we undertook since February 11. Because there were two huge steps, I mean, regardless of how we rate them. But one was the establishment of the committee which worked out the constitutional amendments, and members of the committee were judges, Egyptian judges and legal experts, and they worked in the tradition of that judiciary which looks at itself as a national institution. And the second step was a referendum on Saturday, and the management of the referendum and securing its peaceful and democratic nature was once again primarily upon the judiciary, of course, beside the military establishment, which created a suitable environment for citizens to go to the polling centers and vote. So it's going to be tough, and we will see huge changes in the next years. I mean, probably before September 2011, you will have heard about the creation of maybe 20, if not more, political parties. How many of them will remain after the elections? How many of them will realign after the elections? What kind of blocks will emerge? Are all issues which will be settled after. But we have a clear timeline, and we are looking ahead to the second democratic test, which is the parliamentary elections.
Thanks, Amr. Now it's up to you. Please raise your arms high up. I see a number of arms. The first was this gentleman here. The lady over here.
Francesca Traldi, Magna Carta Foundation. I'd like to know if the social network play any particular role to mobilize the population before the referendum, and if they are used to support it. Thank you.
The gentleman here in the second row, and then we go all the way to the back.
Quick question. How do you explain the military Supreme Council insistence on going ahead with the referendum, knowing that there has been a lot of criticism against it?
And so you are?
Artificial.
Thank you. I saw a hand somewhere up there. In the yes, please.
My name is Ala Olyum from the European External Action Service. Let me first congratulate you, Mr. Hamzawi, from moving from being an observer to being a participant. I salute your courage. My question is also regarding Muslim Brotherhood. The revolution in Egypt was portrayed as being, in a way, a generational one. Do you see also some generational tensions within the Muslim Brotherhood, and how do you see those playing out? And my second question is, what is your advice to Europe as far as those who want to support democratic transition? If you can say one thing we should definitely do, and another thing we should not do. Thank you.
Okay, one more? Mm-hmm. Okay, also all the way back there, and that's the final one for this round, but please keep your questions. We'll go into several other rounds.
Jakub Buratinski, European Commission. Just a very brief question. Your remarks on military sounded quite positive, so maybe a more general question. What's the risk of revolution being stolen and, let's say, the forces of the old order having an upper hand? I mean, and including military in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Amar.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start with the two questions about the Brotherhood. And yes, of course, there are tensions. There are generational tensions. Young members of the Brotherhood were part of the initiation forces on January 25. We had different protest movements coming together on January 25, initiating the dynamism which created the revolution. So the young brothers were part of it. And they have learned to work in a cross-ideological manner, in a manner which does not only look at the interests of the Brotherhood itself, but looks at the national spectrum as well. And those young guys who are quite many of them are very impressive in terms of their political outlook and how they understand what it takes to democratize Egypt, are being marginalized and discriminated in the movement, discriminated against. And of course, this creates tensions. However, and it's an attest to how strong the institution is, the Brotherhood as an institution is, we are yet to hear, and I suspect we will not hear, about any attempt to break away from the movement and establish a different movement or break away from the party initiative which the Brotherhood has launched and will be registering very soon once the new political party law is announced, and this is going to happen probably before the end of that week or early next week. So it's an attest to how strong the organization is, that it manages to sustain and contain those tensions without any attempt to break away. Is that impacting on how the movement conducts itself politically? A bit. But not drastically. We see the Brotherhood basically doing what it has been doing in the last years, which is a bit of initiatives to signal to the wider public opinion that A, they are willing to coordinate with non-religious forces. They have announced recently that they are willing to sit down with everyone to agree on a united list of candidates for the upcoming parliamentary elections. But of course, that came against the background of them stating that they will run for 40%. So it's sort of dividing up the shares. So we keep 40% and we see what we'll do with the rest, more or less of attitude. But you see them as well announcing that they are not up to dominate or rule out the participation of anyone. And when you get to talk with them, and I have had some pleasant and less pleasant encounters with them in the last days, when you listen to them, you listen to them saying that they are not up to dominate Egyptian politics, and then they start using a dangerous mix of religious legitimation and sort of an arrogance which, quote unquote, is legitimate because they know that they are strong and everyone else is not that strong. An arrogance in sort of giving you the constituency argument every time you go and talk to them. Well, we are on the ground, where are you? It is legitimate politically, but it's you cannot build on it if you are really looking for national consensus. So yes, tensions exist, but they are not, to answer your question, they are not moving in any direction close to AK Party in Turkey. And probably it would be too much to ask them to do it before they get their share in the People's Assembly for the first time, a real one, and then we will see what will happen. But it's, I guess, the real changes in the movement, and here I'm speaking as a political scientist and less as an activist, the real changes will happen after the parliamentary elections. After it, we will see whether they are really able to focus on public policy measures and less on ideological claims, whether they will be able to cooperate in a cross-ideological manner between blocs, whether they will be interested in building up national consensus, seriously addressing the red lines, which they perceive as red lines, and we do not perceive, or I do not perceive as red lines, Article 2 and so on and so forth. These are going to be the test cases for the movement, and definitely it will change. But it's not a question which is relevant to them now. The second issue, which is the Supreme Council, and why the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces was determined to run and to conduct the referendum last Saturday, and was determined to suggest the amendments as the way forward. In spite of extensive controversies in Egypt. Well, there are two ways to answer that question now, based on the result or not based on the result. Because if you take the result seriously, well, we have to say, and I'm the first to say it as someone who promoted the no option, maybe they judged the significance of the two groups, of the two camps, of the yes camp and the no camp, better than we did. Because after all, it was a close to 80% outcome. A different way to answer it, not counting, not factoring in the result, is that they are really, and this will answer the last question about risks with regard to the military establishment, that they are really not interested in staying in power the way they are right now for a long time. They would like to get out. They would like to get out. Honestly, they would like to get out. And they have no reason to doubt that they are committed to getting out as soon as possible. It's not that they will give up on playing an indirect political role or shaping Egyptian politics and political and economic development indirectly, but they are overstretched and they do not like what they are doing in terms of managing the country as a legislative and executive force two in one. They would like to get out. They would like to give it to elected institutions. And they were inspired, once again, in honesty and in fairness to them, by a democratic principle which seems convincing if you ignore the timeline, which is it's better to get an elected parliament first than to get an elected president first. Looking back at the history of autocracy in Egypt, which was primarily the outcome of the centrality of the president, They wanted to get from the very beginning sort of a check and balance authority before electing the president. So you can one can really respect where they are coming from. I have no doubt that they are not willing to stay in for a longer time, that they pushed for that track because this seemed to them and seemed to 80% of the Egyptian population, of the Egyptian voters, to be more of a clearly defined transition. 6 months and we have elections, 3 months later we have presidential elections, March 2012 we will have at the latest we'll have the Constitutional Assembly to draft a new constitution, September 2012 we have a new constitution. We try to push back and say, well, what we are suggesting, which is based on a revised timeline, which is elect a new president in September 2011. It's easier to elect a president than to elect a parliament. Get a constitutional assembly directly elected from Egyptian voters and not selected from the parliament. Get it in place before the end of that year, December 2011. Get it to draft the new constitution in 6 months, to discuss it in public hearings, to have a new constitution in 2012. So we more or less, September 2012, we more or less presented the same timeline. But once again, to them, this was a more clear option, clear-cut option, parliament quickly, and they would shift powers to the parliament, keep only the executive prerogatives until a president is elected. So there is a clear will in the Supreme Council not to overdo it, not to stay for a long time, and they are very well aware of the analogies which are on everyone's mind to 1952 to 1954. Because back then, right after the Free Officers' coup, we had a gray zone where Abdel Nasser and his group was supposed to hand over political power to civilians, and this never happened. So we hope we happen this time, because it's yet to happen, right? I mean, we are still looking for the civilians to hand over power too. So finally, right, of course there are different risks in general, apart from the military. And the military is bound, as I said, to stay indirectly involved, to have the safeguarding mission, and to, of course, to protect its benefits and its share in the Egyptian economy. The military owns over 20% of economic assets in Egypt. I mean, they are not going to give it up anytime soon. So we'll have, it's bound to be very similar to what happened in Indonesia in terms of safeguarding military interests and benefits and getting them to do a more structurally more of a safeguarding, to function in a safeguarding mode to protect the democratic experience. But there are other risks. There are risks of a set of actors dominating legislative councils for a longer time. There are risks of a constitution, a new constitution, which does not tackle the huge issues which are contested and are going to be contested, or tackle them from a one-sided perspective. There are structural risks with regard to state building and re-establishing the authority of state institutions based on democratic pillars, creating democratic governance. And countries before Egypt, many of them failed to transition to democracy after democratic citizens' revolution. So there are no guarantees that this will not happen in Egypt. So there are imminent risks. But I'm only ruling out that we reduce our risk perception to one of two directions, to the military or to the Muslim Brotherhood. It's much more than that. In spite of the significance of the two actors.
Mm-hmm. I think there were two questions. One on the generational divide, which you could maybe address real quick, and whether that's going to play out after the revolution. And then more importantly, maybe even for the Brussels audience, what is Europe supposed to do? The question that came from the gentleman
right. All
the way back.
Right. Well, the generational change issue is, I guess it was related to the Muslim Brotherhood, and I did address it. And in general, once again, I mean, as much I have been arguing against perceiving the Egyptian revolution as a middle-class revolution, I completely find it misleading to describe the revolution as a young Egyptian revolution. It's not. I mean, once again, it was really across society, across different age groups and across different social backgrounds. And in fact, geographically, it was really a nationwide revolution. I mean, it was not only Cairo. It was not only Tahrir Square. I mean, of course, Tahrir has come to have a symbolic meaning, but it's, Suez was even more important than Cairo in the first 2 weeks. Alexandria was more dynamic than Cairo in the first 2 weeks. Cairo was decisive in the last few days. What can Europe do? Well, I mean, as I started out with, I am too much in Egypt to know what is going on outside Egypt. I'm even hardly following news in Libya or Yemen or Bahrain. But I can, let me start by the easier component, which is really based on talks that I did have in Cairo with some European foreign ministers, with different ambassadors. And it's really what Europe should not do. I mean, Europe should not reduce its role in helping Egypt to democratize, to reaching out to political parties or civil society organizations and offer them money or technical assistance. This is not what we need. I mean, this is definitely, to my mind, would be the wrong approach. And unfortunately, some, be it at the government level or at the non-governmental level, some European partners are exactly trying to do that, to pick up their preferred list of actors, of civil society organizations, of political party initiatives or existing political parties, and offer them technical assistance or financial aid, or let us know what you need. And this is basically, once again, not the right way to do it. And because it's not the right way, even in the initiative which I am part of, and as I said, it's a liberal initiative, we agreed on a red line, which is do not reach out to European or American organizations as of now. We are not interested in technical assistance. We are not interested in financial assistance. And the most which we would accept, and I guess this applies to many Egyptian actors, political actors, would be if programs, party building programs or civil society programs are offered in a transparent manner, A, in Egypt, B, not outside, C, across ideological differences, do not pick up your preferred or your wish list of seemingly liberal, because you do not know. Even, I mean, my claim that we are establishing a liberal party is a claim, I mean, until the party exists. I mean, do not pick up your wish list and operate based on that. So if it is offered in a transparent, be in Egypt and across ideological differences, and not operating based on the wish list, sort of the Ayman Noor sort of scenario, that would be fine. But this is not where I see Europe being active. Where I see Europe active, and what Europe, to my mind, should do, is to offer at the government-to-government level technical assistance to the Egyptian government in managing the huge challenges of conducting the elections, creating a constitutional assembly, drafting a new constitution, getting that constitution to be nationwide, to be discussed nationwide in public hearings, reflecting on the nationwide debates and including them in the drafting of the constitution. There are so many technical issues where we can benefit from at the government-to-government level. So leave the non-governmental and political party component aside and focus on the government-to-government level. In terms of technical assistance relevant to democracy promotions, there is a huge contribution which Europe can do with regard to state building, to institution building in Egypt at the government-to-government level, security sector reform and beyond the security sector reform. How to create a democratic governance, how to recreate Egyptian institutions based on democratic pillars. That is going to take time. How to translate transparency, accountability in the reality, in the institutional reality in Egypt. Thirdly, and this is really a national demand where the government does not stand anywhere away from national forces, and where national forces, in spite of their differences, ideological, over the referendum, over the constitutional amendments, where they really stand united, what we need is definitely economic assistance. Egypt is economically in a in a bad shape. Not in a bad shape because of the revolution. I mean, it has been in a bad shape for a long time. And there are different initiatives which are emerging domestically, but of course we need economic assistance. We need help in the next tough 2 years. And here you can combine between economic assistance and economic help and state building criteria. I mean, transparency as a criteria, accountability as a criteria. This is a quick answer to what Europe should do and should not do. And I'm more interested in pushing for what should not be done, because I unfortunately saw it being offered in the last weeks in a growing manner, and it's unfortunately really doing the same mistakes once again.
Thanks, Amar. Let's go into a second round. We have one arm up here, a second one there, and then we're also going to the back, and the lady up here. This gentleman first.
Thank you. My name is Muhammad Rajai Barakat. I have many questions. I'll try to be short. We speak about liberalism, and many Arab citizens, when they, even if they are from the left, they speak about liberalism. And here we have another notion, another meaning for liberalism. Would you please explain the difference between your liberalism in the Arab countries and the liberalism in Europe, or in the... you speak about democracy, and 80% of Egyptians are not involved in democracy, in the political life. You know, even here in Europe, we vote every 2 years or 3 or 4 years, and then we don't feel that we are involved in the political life. And what's the future of Mr. Mubarak or Mubarak's family? I read in Egyptian newspapers during the 2 last weeks that even ministers, former ministers of the government, were involved in terrorism actions in Alexandria, in Sharm el Sheikh, in Taba. What's going to happen on this level? Thank you.
Okay, I think we're going to take the lady up here in the front, and then we go to the rear over there.
First of all, I'd like to wish you luck in your upcoming projects, and hopefully you'll manage.
Please closer to the microphone,
please. Energy wave. I have a question on the. By the way, my name is Ruth Bayada from the External Action Service. I have a question on the Salafi groups that you mentioned. How strong and organized are they, and are they in any way linked to the Brotherhood? And what role would you envisage for them in a new democratic Egypt? And a second question, I know you did not want to speak about Egyptian foreign policy, but surely Egypt is a big country in the region, and we've already started seeing saying that Egypt is on the route for smuggling. You have the Sinai problem, you had the ship that was meant to go to Alexandria. Do you think that Egypt will regain a role in the region, and what kind of role do you envisage for it?
Okay. We go now to the rear. I saw an arm up, and then this gentleman up here was next. Who was it in the back who wanted to have? Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is Borgogni, European Commission. I would like to tackle the question of the Brotherhood from another angle. The current debate on the constitutional amendment has been polarized with the facilitation of the mandate that the mandate of the president should be reduced, and to extend the representation in the parliament. That is for sure an important aspect of the democracy. Nevertheless, I think that the time could be mature also to tackle the religious aspect in the constitution. Article 2, I think, is saying that, and it's not only in Egypt, that Egypt is an Islamic republic, and is basing is a low aspiration from the Islam. Don't you think that this could be an aspect that should be tackled? And if so, how do you think that the international organization could work on it? for example, on the civil society organization base.
Okay, thank you. Let's keep it at this. This gentleman maybe up here. Ida, this, yeah, thank you.
Hello, I'm Vít Novotný from the Center for European Studies. Just to ask about the demonstrations in Egypt, I guess, you know, so many people turned up, 14 million, and I suppose you need something more than a negative vision of getting rid of the, you know, dictators, they perceive the president and the establishment. Was there any positive reference point that brought together everybody who was demonstrating on the streets?
Okay, final one?
Sure.
We take one more. Okay, oops, this gentleman up here, please.
My name is Tamer Hudafrawi. I have two questions, actually. The first one is related to the political front that you announced that you would be doing. Can you talk more about this and how can individual Egyptian people participate and support that front? That's the first question. Second question is again related to the Muslim Brotherhood. And what odds do you think they have of gaining more than 50% of the People's Assembly? And how can the political front that you are aiming to launch help reduce in that percentage?
Right. Amar, we nominally have 5 minutes left, but please take 7 if you need them.
Sure. Let me, okay. Let me start with the last two questions. The initiative which I am part of is composed briefly of representatives of those 80% Egyptian voters who really never participated in politics before. And the core of it is a group of mid-career and young professionals coming from non-political backgrounds, corporate business, banks, the academia, and not only social science, but social science, technical sciences, natural sciences. And so it's you have one huge component, and those, to my mind, are the citizens who made the revolution. Some of them were organized in networks, like the Alliance of the January 25 Youth, which is composed out of 12 networks and movements, and some were not organized. The second group is representatives of the business community. A third group, which is basically sort of the intellectual arm of what's going on, writers, intellectuals. A fourth group, which takes you outside urban centers. The first three groups are really urban-based. A fourth group which takes you outside urban centers to different regions in Egypt and is structured in too many, according to different logics. One is a Coptic component. We have had in Egypt in the last years a very dynamic scene, civil society scene among Egyptian Copts, and they are, which is one of the greatest, to my mind, achievements of the revolution, that they are now mobilized and interested in participating in politics. I mean, in fact, if you take it as from a sectorial perspective, Copts participated in the most extensive participation in the referendum on Saturday came from Egyptian Copts. Early estimates, over 70%, which is very impressive. So we have a component based on the civil society, on the Coptic civil society scene. We have different components related to El Baradai campaigns and campaigns which were launched in the last 2 years to push for democratization. We have finally a component taking us to connections to labor unions, independent labor unions and professional associations, and initiatives which have been going on since 2 to 4 years to establish independent labor unions. So that's what we are trying to do. At the beginning, we tried sort of a mix between left of the center and right of the center to merge and not to allow for limited resources and limited time to be sort of wasted over ideological differences. But that formula seems to be more sort of less productive in terms of attracting citizens to join and less productive in terms of enabling us to work quickly. So we an attempt to establish a left of the center party platform was announced last Friday. We will probably coordinate before the elections, and our attempt to establish a liberal, socially responsible platform will be announced next week. How to counter the power of the Brotherhood is a tough question. But once again, you have to get into the test and get started right away. We do not have the luxury of building neatly defined party structures. Basically, it comes down to nominating candidates, pushing them to their districts, and getting them to do their electoral campaigns right away. So we will wait and see. We are still unclear about how many candidates we would like to run, as well as everyone else in Egypt outside the Brotherhood. Everyone else is unclear about how many candidates the respective organization or party is going to run. This question will be debated. To the liberal platform and what it means in Egypt, very briefly in order not to go over the time, it means a commitment to the market economy, to a socially responsible market economy similar to what we have here, but taking into consideration the big economic and social difference between Western European countries and Egypt, but a socially responsible market economy. Secondly, a commitment to the civil nature of Egyptian politics and of the Egyptian state. And here the civil component is against a militarization of Egyptian politics as well as an Islamization of Egyptian politics, a commitment to equal citizenship rights to Egyptians regardless of their religious affiliation, Muslims and Copts, and a commitment to the human rights, the international frame of reference, human rights frame of reference as a binding frame of reference for civil liberties, political rights, and social and economic rights. That's more or less where we stand. The challenge will be to translate that before the elections in a party platform to make policy measures out of it. What else do I have? Salafi groups, and I will stop. Well, that's, you know what? I'm really not interested in what's going to happen to Mubarak. I mean, we are done with him. I mean, he is a removed president. He is from a legal perspective. He is a potential criminal. He cannot leave the country. His assets are frozen. The ones which we could put our hand on, God knows how much we could not put our hands on. But I'm, whatever will happen to him, he is out of Egyptian politics, and he. I'm very much against sort of losing track and devoting attention to what will happen to the Mubarak family. I mean, once again, there is a clear legal path which is being followed against him and his family. We are demanding more globally a transitional justice institution similar to the Reconciliation Committee which we had in different countries that transitioned to democracy. And not only a selective treatment with a focus on Mubarak and his son and his wife. And, there was an excellent joke in Egypt on February 12. And I mean, the Salafi groups is a very tough question. Are they linked to the brother? I would like to end on a happy note with a joke, not with the Salafi group, which is a depressing issue. So are they linked to the Brotherhood? Yes and no. What kind of political role they will play, they are making up their mind. The fact is that they have a very strong presence, especially in Upper Egypt, and that they have been unchecked. Their power and their outreach has been unchecked for a very long time. And they are gradually trying to push forward their views, their perceptions, and there is a degree of openness from not only the military establishment, but from the Brotherhood to listen to them, to include them, which is fine as long as you demand them to deliver what is what should be delivered in a democratic polity. But that's going to be very tough. I mean, I was in the delegation, political delegation, which went to the village in which the church was burned. And what I saw there was a different Egypt, a completely different Egypt, where the tension between Salafi groups and the Coptic population was a lesson to my mind, a lesson in sort of being humble and not overestimating the outreach we can have as liberal and leftist groups in that social fabric we are looking at. But it's okay. To end on a joke, on February 13. So the rumor was that Mubarak died. And so the joke in town was, well, no, he should not die now. He should just see what we are doing once we removed him. So people were really happy to know. Some wished Mubarak to die before February 11. Mm-hmm. Once we removed him, the wish was, no, he should stay and stay awake and see what is happening in the country mm-hmm. once he was removed. And he is, once again, I mean, on Mubarak, he is in Sharm el-Sheikh. There were some rumors that he is trying to sort of, behind the scenes, to influence what's going on, but he is definitely out of the picture, and the military establishment has no interest whatsoever in getting him back again. So it's done. That part of Egyptian history with Mubarak is over. The system is still there, but he and his family are out of the picture.
Amr, thank you very much for your patience with us and for being here when, you know, there's much, much bigger fish to fry in your home country.
Right.
I have a very, very brief one for you, so to break the time bank here on my own expense. David Cameron in London gave a speech after Mubarak was ousted from office, and it was like a huge apology almost on behalf of the West, that they had sat on the wrong horse, that, you know, that the entire strategy of, you know, valuing stability over democracy, that had failed and we needed to change, and it was now a huge watershed and the West would have to behave differently in the future. Was that perceived to be helpful? Was that perceived to be a joke?
No.
How was that being perceived in the country?
Well, I mean, it was not perceived.
Okay.
Period. So, I mean, for good reasons. I mean, this came too late. It came after such devastating Western reluctance to endorse the democracy movement in Tunisia and in Egypt. And the same reluctance, apart from what's going on in Libya, the same reluctance I'm seeing unfolding in Yemen, I'm seeing unfolding in Bahrain. A military intervention by the Saudis in Bahrain is being dealt with silently, in spite of the highly undemocratic nature of it. No, it was not perceived. I met the Prime Minister in Egypt, and I highly value his commitment to democracy. But once again, I mean, as long as it's a rhetorical commitment, as long as it's not translated in policy measures in the right time, these statements and speeches will continue to be not perceived in Egypt. There is an interesting component in, and here more of a regional perspective. I mean, Arab citizens really feel empowered for the first time. It's a homegrown issue. I mean, this was not imposed on us, and we were not helped by anyone. We did it on our own. And that sense of empowerment is very, very central to understand why, in spite of the bloodshed in Libya, and in spite of crimes against humanity, people are still standing up to Qaddafi and trying to push him out, or in spite of the killing of around 60 Yemeni civilians in a night, people are still protesting. In Bahrain, once again, in spite of the Saudi intervention. So there's a sense of empowerment which is homegrown, and I am glad that this cannot be interpreted or cannot be declared to be the outcome of any meaningful or significant Western policy, because that policy did not exist.
Amr, you said that there was a risk of romanticizing the good old days of the revolution. Now, you know, that we are a couple of weeks into the post-revolution period. You sounded like a very clear-headed romantic today. Thanks for combining the activism
right.
and the analysis. Thanks
right.
for being with us.
Sure,
thanks
my pleasure.
To all of you for being here early in the evening today. And please return to Carnegie on the occasion of our next event. Thank you very much. Good night.